Our most recent Nobel laureate tells us that the universe is accelerating. Something called dark energy is involved. There is chatter about time travel, and we all know where that leads.
Fighting for my future.
Me too.
Get up, come here. I'm sorry, I could have hit my target, but you fell all wrong.
Sometimes in life you can't help which way you fall.
You do know when I walk through those doors, they're going to come for me.
Yeah. Well, there's only one thing for it. That's fire up the quattro.
Some dialogue and music there from Ashes to Ashes, the original soundtrack, Volume 3. The feature track was The Love Cats by The Cure, and it shows, Michael, you should always be wary about time travel and dark energy.
My belief, exactly, Paul. Full recording details on the Counterpoint website. And coming up next, why everything you think you know about the collapse of the Soviet Union is wrong.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Counterpoint with Michael Duffy and Paul Comrie Thompson.
The Arab Spring has been an occasion for some of us to reflect on the causes of previous revolutions and great changes, including the collapse of Soviet Russia. Just why did the USSR fall to pieces? Well, our next guest, Leon Aron, has published an article on this in Foreign Policy magazine. It's very interesting. Leon is Director of Russian Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and he joins us now to talk about it. Leon, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
We tend to forget, but almost no one predicted the collapse of the USSR, did they?
No, nobody did. It happened very, very quickly. I put it at 4 years. Gorbachev became the General Secretary in 85. For 2 years, till 87, he tried to meddle around pretty much the same way as before, and then he finally decided in January of 87 to have something that he thought was very decent and good, but hardly revolutionary. He essentially abolished the censorship in the mass media. But that was enough for the thing to collapse.
No, well, there was an enormous change, and yet there appeared to be very few indications of it, were there? Things seemed to be the same as they had been in the past, the economic situation, for example.
Yes, absolutely. In retrospect, of course, and at the time, clearly there were enormous problems, poverty, the GDP started to slow down in terms of its growth. In terms of consumer goods, it was Stone Age. But, Russia had been through more difficult times, say, after World War II, and the regime survived. Part of the reason that nobody could predict is because, not because that we didn't try to predict, but that we generally look at precisely the indicators that you mentioned, how the economy is doing, do we have any what's known as structural changes, for the worse. And there were none. And therefore, everybody, although aware of the problem, said, 20, 30, in any case, during our lifetime, nothing will happen.
Yeah, I suppose one of the things one might assume would occur before a revolution is some sort of upsurge of dissidents. Was that really happening in Russia at this time?
Well, see, this is where we get into the difference between totalitarian regimes and authoritarian regimes. The Soviet Union was a totalitarian regime, meaning that all the dissidents, as I write in that article, were either dead or exiled abroad or exiled and arrested inside or in camps and prisons. Just to mention probably the best-known one, Andrei Sakharov, was in exile in a city of Gorky where very, very few people could actually reach him. He was not formally arrested, but de facto was under house arrest. And so those types of regimes deal very, very systematically with dissent. While we admire the dissidents, it was clear that they're not going to bring the system down.
One story that one hears sometimes today is that It was a sort of flow-on effect from changes that had occurred in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland, you know, changes that had been encouraged by, in some cases, by America, in some cases, by the Pope. How strong a factor do you think that really was?
Well, you know, there was a tremendously inspiring and a hopeful movement, if you remember, the Polish dock workers. It was something that the Soviet Union was utterly unprepared for, and that was anathema to anything that Marxism teaches. Those were Catholic, anti-communist workers. Something that is very difficult to comprehend for somebody steeped in very orthodox Marxism. And if you remember, in 1980, there was a spectacular victory where the strikes in Gdansk, led by Lech Wałęsa, was successful. I mean, the government did come down to negotiate. But by 1985, it was all gone. If you remember that a year later, there was a military coup in Poland, and although the Soviet army did not interfere, as it did in Hungary in 56 or Czechoslovakia in 68, it was sort of done internally, as it were, and it was pretty much snuffed away.
Yeah, so that was over too. I suppose another story we hear a lot of today is that indirectly Russia collapsed because of the pressure put on it by Ronald Reagan's defense build-up, his military build-up, and Russia tried to compete and it couldn't. Is there any truth in that?
There is some truth to it. But again, you have to remember that the military-industrial complex in Russia was at least 30% of the GDP. In these types of regimes, you know, it's very difficult to sort of spend somebody into the ground. Particularly, don't forget, in the 1970s, the price of oil went up very sharply, and Russia discovered oil in Western Siberia. I think what scared them a little bit was that how far ahead technologically the United States was. But so what? You know, Russia was behind the United States technologically in, you know, 1949, yet it acquired its own nuclear bomb. So I think they felt that it was a hard task, but that they certainly could accomplish it.
Leon, your article in Foreign Policy has the title, "Everything You Think You Know About the Collapse of the Soviet Union is Wrong." And I think we've just gone through some of the conventional explanations and knocked them over. We've cleared some space. So now for the positive question. If those things weren't responsible for it, what do you think really did happen there?
I think we forget that at the very beginning of any revolution, there is a thirst for dignity. If you look at every revolution, modern revolution, starting with the British Revolution, American Revolution, French Revolution, it did not start because people, you know, the leaders sat down and said, well, look, these political institutions are really constraining our economy. They really need to go, which is what, you know, the so-called historical materialism tells us. And there's some truth to it, too. The outcome may be like that, but that's not how people think. They are extremely concerned, and here, you know, when the explosion occurs, nobody knows. But if you remember, it all started with, in Tunisia, well, actually, the Arab Spring started with a fruit seller burning himself. Why? Because he was constantly insulted. He was, you know, his fruit was requisitioned by the police. They spat on him. They beat him when he went to the local authorities. They stick police on him. People could take a certain amount of indignity for a long time, but then something happened. And that's always a miracle, because the timing is always a miracle. Mm. And I think in the Russian case, what happened was that, as I mentioned before, the censorship was abolished. And all of a sudden, and you know, this article is based on a book that's coming out this spring, where I actually record all of this in detail. All of a sudden, people started reading in the newspapers what they saw, but thought was just them. They thought it was just an individual case. All the indignity inflicted by the bureaucracy, all the lining up for the basic items of food, all the insults by you know, local authorities, all the fear before the police, all the necessity to mouth the slogans nobody believed in, all the lies all around them. But all of a sudden they realize, oh, my God, you know, this is not just me. This is the system. others feel the same way. And in my book, I record the outpouring of letters to the editor and also the quadrupling and then quadrupling again the press runs of newspapers and magazines, which incidentally is exactly what happened in Egypt as well. So once people realize that they are systematically degraded as citizens, that they're systematically insulted by the regime, and if they feel that there is solidarity forming, then I think it gets dangerous and it gets revolutionary.
That's a very interesting idea, and yet as you, or in addition, as you point out in your article, the regime itself, or at least some parts of it, had a similar feeling, didn't they? I mean, Gorbachev was trying to liberalize the place.
Yes, and that is again not to tire out you and your listeners. This is again the difference between the regimes. In an authoritarian regime like Egypt, Tunisia, and so on, where this, you know, or Russia today, by the way, where there's certain amount of freedom. You know, I mean, this, you know, you could, by the way, the internet is free. You could say whatever you want. There's even opposition press that allowed. I mean, in a very, very small way. Television is completely censored everywhere in these regimes. But you know, you could at least say things. People go to the internet. People go to the Facebook. Right? In the totalitarian regime, it has to start from above. It must. Because all other channels are completely clogged. Everything has been severed. And so somebody above got to have decency. And in my book, I go, I comb through the memoirs of Gorbachev, Shevardnadze, who was the first foreign minister, Alexander Yakovlev, the so-called godfather of glasnost. They all say the same thing. They all felt, almost in these words, we cannot live like this anymore. They did not want the revolution. They did not want to change the economic system. I think they believe in the socialist system. But they thought that they could keep it, but also give people some basic foundations of dignity. You know, uncensored media, competitive elections, the ability to gather and petition, and, you know, the basic human and political freedoms.
Yeah.
And that's where they were wrong.
You said that the people at the top, Gorbachev and some others, you know, felt they couldn't go on living like that. Any idea why that happened at that particular point? Why was it that generation and not the previous one?
That's an excellent question. Several things. For one thing, the Gorbachev generation did not really struggle. They did not live not only through the civil war. They didn't even experience Stalinism. Gorbachev was 12 years old when Stalin died. And so, unlike the previous generations of the Soviet leaders, I think they were delusional. I mean, I think they believed that basically people are very happy with the system. There are some problems, like I said, you know, there are certain instances of indignity which could be removed. Gorbachev called it alluvia on the healthy body of socialism. But it was given to them on a silver platter. They did not know what was involved. Unlike, by the way, the generation that grew up under Stalin, working for Stalin, that's the generation Leonid Brezhnev, who died in 1982, and Yuri Andropov, who died in 1984. So they felt that the system is basically is based on not on violence and constant fear, but on fairly rational kind of foundations, and that's why they were very bold in by the Soviet standards in their reforms, but clearly experimentally they've been proven wrong.
Yeah, sure. Leon, let's just briefly end with the Arab Spring, which is sort of where we began all this. You've talked about a number of similarities between what happened in Russia and the Arab Spring. Are there any other lessons you think that we could learn, perhaps, about what's happening in the Middle East now from what happened in the USSR?
Well, there are inspiring lessons, which is that, just as we had been told about the Russians that, oh, my God, you know, no, no, you know, the professors particularly like to say it in the West. Well, you know, we need liberty, and we need, you know, we really need, you know, consumer goods, and we can't stand in line to buy, you know, a dozen of eggs. But the Russians, you know, they're different. They really, if not like it, that's fine with them. Well, that was wrong. People don't like their dignity insulted. Yeah. And the same thing, you remember, I mean, up until the Arab Spring, you know, there was a very strong current in at least in the U.S. Expert opinion that, you know, these are Arabs. You know, there's a long historical tradition of, you know, of kind of subservience and authoritarianism, exactly like in Russia. And therefore, you know, they're kind of used to it, and they'll take more, and, you know, nothing really will happen. Well, they were wrong. Now for a bit less cheery lesson, and that is, look what happened to the Russian Revolution. They got all the institutions correctly. You know, the Constitution is brilliant, 93, Yeltsin's Constitution. I wrote about all of this in my biography of Boris Yeltsin. They had remarkable devotion by intelligentsia, and yet, you know, it all dissolved, and now we see Vladimir Putin self-coronating himself again for the next 12 years. Why? Because those institutions were imposed on the kind of subsoil of civil society that was scared, unused to controlling the government, and unable to take responsibility for itself and the country. That only comes with years. And by the way, I think Putin will not be able to serve out his 12 years, because this kind of thing in the 21st century, that simply does not happen. You know, you cannot do this in a fairly industrialized European country, even if it's Russia. Well, and the reason I'm saying this is because I just traveled through Russia, literally from end to end, from Vladivostok to Kaliningrad in July, talking to the leaders of civil society, essentially civil rights movements. And it's a generation that is not going to stand for this. And again, we don't know when this insult to their dignity, which is, you know, essentially a total profanation of any democratic procedures, like I said, coronation, when it's going to get to, as it were, a number of people enough to form the critical mass. But I think the civil society in Russia, as well as in the Arab countries, must, I guess, mature is the word, you know, and revolutions usually run ahead. Don't forget, by the way, that every revolution, every modern revolution, followed by restoration. So did the British, the French, you know, remember? Mm-hmm. It took the French 70 years to get to a more or less stable Third Republic in 1870s. That's a long time from 1789. So the civil society kind of has to catch up, as it were, with the political change, to take control, to control the government, and not to be afraid of the government.
Leon, these are very interesting thoughts, and if Putin does leave, we might ask you back on the program to talk about that. But in the meantime, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Leon Aron, Director of Russian Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, talking about his cover story in Foreign Policy magazine, Everything You Think You Know About the Collapse of the Soviet Union Is Wrong.
And that's it for us this week. Counterpoint was produced by John Cochrane and Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is and always will be John Diamond. I'm Paul Comrie-Thompson.
And I'm Michael Duffy. See you next week.